I'm Jay Crowe, the editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our contributing editor, James Mottram.
Hello.
Hello. And our contributor, Leila Lateef.
Hello.
Hello, you two. So this week we're rating Ghostbusters Afterlife, The Power of the Dog, King Richard and Petit Maman. But before we get to those, what have you guys been watching this week? Leila?
I've been doing a lot of kick-ass ladies this week because I sometimes write for American publications. I get some TV shows a bit earlier than the English ones. So I've been watching Yellow Jackets.
All right, don't show off.
I know, but I was worried that that wasn't going to come out in England until I picked up this issue. And there was a fab interview with the people with the lovely Tara Bennett. So that is definitely coming to England at some point on Now TV and Sky Atlantic. And I really recommend it. Like They're saying it's like gender flip Lord of the Flies, but it's so much more than that. It's that plus Mean Girls, plus the Blair Witch Project, plus, you know, like Twin Peaks. It really is absolutely nuts and so much fun. And I've been watching, and I just watched Bruise, the new Halle Berry film where she's playing an MMA fighter coming back for kind of one last shot at glory. Her son, who she has had adopted, kind of reappears into her life. So it's kind of half a bit of a naff sports film and then half quite a good drama about a damaged woman trying to repair her relationship with her son. But yeah, I think it's a good showcase for Halle Berry's talent at any rate. She really deserves more than I think she got in her career.
Didn't she direct that one as well?
Yes, she did.
So it's her directorial debut as well.
Yeah, and I think it is one of those things with, you know, maybe it's a little egotistical, but she really does. It's her film. Like, that camera is very much into every expression that she's making and every kind of like kick-ass bit of action that she's able to do. So, yeah, it is kind of funny that you would direct a film that was so focused on you acting as well.
Mm. Yes. James, what have you been watching? Any kick-ass women in your life?
Well, I've been...
Apart from your mum, obviously.
Obviously. I've been dipping my hands into some kitchen sink drama, revisiting some old Mike Leigh films because there's a big BFI season of his work on at the moment. So I saw Naked on Saturday and then Meantime. And I forgot what a phenomenal cast that's got in it. Gary Oldman, Tim Roth, Phil Daniels, Alfred Molina... Marion Bailey, incredible, incredible cast. So just, yeah, revisiting those and got to see Lee do a Q&A after Naked as well with Leslie Sharp. And he was in a fabulously grumpy mood.
So always is, isn't he?
As he always is.
Yes. Reliably grumpy is Mike Lee. And we wouldn't want him any other way, would we?
Quite.
Okay. Shall we get on then and see if any of the films this week are going to make us grumpy? Leila? Oh, she's gone. I think she must have been taken... by the spirit world or ghosts, bearing in mind what we're about to talk about.
Well, that was a brief appearance, but very, very welcome.
She's disappeared. Right. I don't think she's coming back. She's just texted me. She isn't. Let me just put a text in to Jordan Farley and see if he can come. Right. Jordan's coming, James. Don't worry. Oh, he's here. Jordan, hello.
Hello.
Thank you for coming in to save the day like a Ghostbuster.
No problem. If anyone ever needs me to talk about Ghostbusters, I'm there. You live in Scotland, I'll drive up. No problem. I'll talk about Ghostbusters anywhere, anytime.
Okay, perfect. So let's get started.
Egon came out here for a reason.
Are you troubled by strange noises in the middle of the night?
Do you experience feelings of dread in your basement or attic?
Have you or any of your family ever seen a spook, specter, or ghost?
Oh my God.
You guys hear that?
Something's coming.
Okay, so that is Ghostbusters Afterlife. James, tell us where we find the Ghostbusters.
Well, first of all, we are not in New York. We are in Somerville, Oklahoma, which is a sort of small dead-end town in the middle of nowhere, as they like to say. And we meet Callie, played by Carrie Coon, who has two kids, Trevor, played by Finn Wolfhard, from Stranger Things, of course, and Phoebe, played by McKenna Grace. And she's broke, and she's had to move to Somerville to take over this ramshackle house owned by her estranged father. Now, immediately we're not told who her father is. It becomes clear, certainly if you look at her kids, you'll be able to work it out, that their grandfather was one of the Ghostbusters. And that becomes pretty clear fairly soon in, as they start finding rather familiar equipment all around the house, sort of proton packs, ghost traps, and a rather nice familiar white Cadillac. Their grandfather, Callie's father, has just passed away, which is why she's inherited the house. And she's just trying to establish her life in Somerville. But it becomes pretty clear that there's some paranormal activity happening, or spectral activity happening in Somerville. Why? Well, you'll have to sort of dig further into the film to find out. But Phoebe, the younger of the two children, is a complete science nerd. And she soon hooks up with Mr. Gruberson, played by Paul Rudd, who's a summer school teacher who has an interest in sort of seismic activity. And he's been trying to figure out why there's all this strange activity going on, given there are no tectonic plates near the town. They soon all hook up, start to use the familiar Ghostbusters equipment. They even find a ghost trapped inside inside one of those ghost traps, which gets released. And, you know, carnage and chaos, and ghostly chaos starts happening.
Yeah, cats and dogs, total chaos, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, we must also remind everyone that Paul Rudd is currently the world's sexiest man, or the sexiest man alive, isn't he? Is he doing it for you, James, in this film?
But I liked Paul Rudd in this, actually. He's kind of the sort of Rick Moranis figure. He's not playing that character, but there was a moment later on, I won't reveal how, but he sort of emerges from somewhere with a Rick Moranis style haircut, with the kind of hair sort of going in all directions. I mean, he's also in the Shrink Next Door at the moment with Will Ferrell, playing a much more serious kind of role. But I really enjoy watching him. Of course, he brings a little bit of the Ant-Man character into this. He's not the central focus of this story, but I did enjoy seeing Rudd in this. He's a familiar face that's always very, very watchable.
And Carrie Coon, he and Carrie Coon, they're not, as you say, they're not the main event here. It's the kids, isn't it? This is definitely a Ghostbusters for a new generation, but that is incredibly nostalgic and a spiritual follow-up, literally and figuratively. But, you know, I do think Rudd and Carrie Coon are important here, because it's not just a kids' movie. That's what's key about this for me, is that those two are playing comedy and sort of pathos as well on a whole different level, so that there is something for everybody in this film. And I just really found that this would be a film that you could literally take the whole family to. It's one of those four quadrant films.
Yeah, absolutely. I suppose the original movie, the 1984 film, was a bit more adult skewed, I thought. Yeah. I mean, kids could definitely enjoy it. But I think with the presence, obviously, of Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd, there was always that slight, you know, Saturday Night Live adult twinge to the characters. And that's much less so here. Like you said, the kids are the main focus. But I think that's a really good way of getting in a new generation of youngsters who probably don't really know the original movie, or may have heard of it but may not have seen it. And I think this is a really good introduction into that universe. Carrie and Paul's characters do provide that little bit of more adult perspective on the story as well. Could be a little bit of romance going on, maybe just a little bit. I was really taken with this film. I'm sadly old enough to remember the first film coming out. I did queue up in the snow in Hastings to see that film. This is a massive, massive nostalgia trip. I mean, I've seen critical reviews of this film saying it's massive fan service, and I think that's okay. I don't mind that, really. It's very in tune with the objects that we're familiar for, like I mentioned earlier, the proton packs, the car, the traps.
Oh, there's loads of Easter eggs, aren't there? Yeah. Loads.
And you get I'm not even sure if they're Easter eggs. They're sort of, it's the paraphernalia that makes the uniforms, of course. I mean, I'm sure if you go and watch it for a second time, there are proper Easter eggs that I didn't pick up. But it made me feel very, very nostalgic for the 1980s. And I'm sure people of my age will feel that when they watch this. You know, how young kids will feel, I don't know. But that's why I think it's important to have those young characters as the way in for them into the story.
And Jordan, what did you think of it? I mean, you said at the top that you're a massive fan. Did this work for you? I mean, James and I are sort of saying that this works for the whole family, but does it work for hardened fans like you?
Oh, 100%. To me, this is a film that was made for, you know, the hardcore fan. I've loved Ghostbusters since I was 4 years old, barely able to walk around the house. I was carrying a proton pack and throwing traps around trying to catch my sister. So yeah, it really felt like this was a film that was pushing all my buttons. It's not a spoiler to say that the OG Busters were involved in this film in some capacity. Obviously, we're not going to spoil precisely how they're involved, but oh my God, I got such a thrill from seeing those guys back on screen. It was
such chills, right?
I know, exactly. It was like seeing, you know, a lightsaber ignite again in The Force Awakens or something. It was that kind of level of excitement for me. I was absolutely just bowled over by it all. But that's not really the film, you know. It's about a family. It's about a mother who has badly fallen out with her father. In this case, the father happens to be Egon Spengler. But, you know, that's all very relatable stuff. It's about young kids trying to find their way in the world and deal with their kind of family's legacy. Like, all that stuff's quite interesting. That's quite meaty family drama stuff. That really all comes from Jason Reitman and his background in dramatic storytelling. That isn't a typical kind of Ghostbusters story. And I found that really interesting that it was mixing the genres. You get all the fun action, you get the ghost busting, the traps, the PKE meters, all that kind of stuff. But I like that this was actually trying to do something quite different with a Ghostbusters film. I really appreciated that, even as someone who really just wanted to see people busting ghosts on screen. I was glad that I wasn't just seeing the same old thing again.
But it is kind of familiar, in as much as for me, it sort of reminded me of E.T., you know, that sort of even the way that they sort of talk over each other and you know, the family dynamic is sort of similar to that setup with E.T. when, you know, there's everyone's eating pizza and the mum's washing up and everything. And it's all sort of this domestic sort of activity. It sort of reminded me of that. And I didn't have any problem with that at all either. I loved that idea.
I love that too. He's kind of dialed up the Amblin 80s nature of his inspirations here. You know, there's a fair bit of Poltergeist in this film, which is interesting because, you know, Gil Keenan, the co-writer of Ghostbusters Afterlife, actually directed the Poltergeist remake. But, you know, a lot of his inspiration comes from those 80s classics, E.T. being a big one. I love just all that stuff about it. It felt nostalgic, but it didn't feel exploitative, which I thought was a very fine line to walk.
It doesn't feel cynical either. It feels warm and fuzzy and familiar and all of those things. And it seems to have pissed some people right off that it's all those things, doesn't it? I mean, some people have really taken against this. Why, James? Why?
I saw some really vicious reviews out there before. I kind of avoided reading the reviews because I hadn't seen the film at that point, and then went back to read one in particular, which was a one-star review. I was stunned, really, that people were taking so much offense to the film. It's a very cozy, comfortable film that it really gets you back into that Ghostbusters mold, as Jordan said. You know, what's not to like about seeing people busting ghosts? I mean, I really thought that the central car chase, let's call it, ghost car chase through the town of Somerville was incredible. It was thrilling. You got to see a little bit more about what that car is capable of as well, which I thought was great. I mean, so it wasn't like they were just formulaically copying elements from the original movie. They were adding and embellishing them. No, I was absolutely stunned that people were completely taken against this film in some capacity.
And there's a cameo, which you won't say. There's obviously certain cameos, but there's one cameo that's on for a few seconds of a great actor that's just like, it's got everything going on. I'm talking about beep. Just little touches like that, there's really good quality people involved in this film and the original Ghostbusters. Would they have come back if they thought they were pissing on their own chips? I feel like there's a stamp of approval going on here with the quality of the people that Reitman's got involved, and the fact that obviously his father, who directed the original, is also sitting next to him in the director's chair, sort of advising on any elements he might be unsure of. I feel like it's the golden ticket.
Yeah, literally sitting next to him on set as well, Ivan Reitman. He had a director's chair right next to his son, Jason Reitman's director's chair. And I actually interviewed Jason Reitman for the magazine for our cover feature a couple of months ago. And he was telling me he would just, if he ever wasn't sure about something, he would just turn to his dad and say, you know, is the color of the slime right? Is the wind blowing hard enough here? Like, is this what you would have done in 1984 when you made the original? Like, I mean, like, you can't ask for a more authentic opinion than that, can you really?
Yeah, absolutely. It also sort of leaves it open for possible further ghost busting. Would you like to see more based on this one?
Yeah, I don't see why not. We won't talk about them, but there's a couple of post-credit stings. That's kind of like de rigueur these days, isn't it, with sort of big Hollywood films. Let's shove a couple of post-credit stings in just to show that we're going forward, potentially, if the audiences like it. But I'd totally be up to seeing another one. If it had the same spirit, I thought this really did capture the spirit of the original in certain ways. So if it was doing the same thing, yeah, why not?
And also that post-credit sequence, one of them actually does do something to dial back some issues that people might have had with the original film in terms of sort of sexism and toxic masculinity, which I appreciated. No spoilers, but I think they did a pretty funny and careful job with that.
Yeah, I think one of the really interesting things that the film does is it kind of broadens the idea of who a Ghostbuster can be, because I think there was a sort of belief with those original films that if you're not Bill Murray, you're not Dan Aykroyd, you're not Harold Ramis, or you're not Ernie Hudson, you can't be a Ghostbuster.
And if you're not a man, you can't be a Ghostbuster.
Exactly.
Melissa McCarthy or Kristen Wiig.
Well, exactly. If you're not a middle-aged man who was on SNL in the 80s, then you're not allowed to be a Ghostbuster. I mean, you mentioned the Paul Feig film. That really did sort of open the doors initially. But it felt like with this film that anyone from a 12-year-old girl to a 60-year-old man can be a Ghostbuster now. It felt like I could pop on a flight suit and pick up a proton pack and go and bust some ghosts if I wanted to. Like that was quite a lovely kind of note about the film. And in a cynical sense, it opens doors to more films with more people, more different people playing Ghostbusters. But that's all good as far as I'm concerned.
Yes. What would you give to strap on a proton pack, Jordan? I know you would love to.
I mean, it's my ultimate dream, basically. It's literally having a nuclear reactor strapped to your back.
Yes.
I'd be willing to take the risk. Is there anything cooler than a proton pack? Hell yeah.
Or even just the dungarees or the overalls, I should say.
I've done that before, plenty of times.
Done it before, James.
Dressed as a Ghostbuster.
Of course he has.
That's just a Saturday night, dressing up like a Ghostbuster.
Yeah, let's not go into that. Okay, so if you want to get into your Ghostbuster jam, it's Ghostbusters Afterlife, and it's in cinemas from today. You can go from today. Right, time to saddle up, cowboys. It's time for this.
It's just a man, Peter. Only another man.
A man was made by patience and the odds against him.
For what kind of man would I be if I did not help my mother? Not save her.
Okay, so this is Power of the Dog, which is Jane Campion's adaptation of a novel by the same name, and it's about a pair of brothers in Montana who've been quite close but are set adrift when one of them, played by Jesse Plemons, marries a widowed mother of a teenage boy and brings her to live at the ranch, much to the disgust of Phil, played by Benedict Cumberbatch, who is a cowpoke who doesn't like anything other than cowboy stuff, macho stuff. It's pretty amazing. It's a bit awardsy. I think it's Benedict Cumberbatch's best performance to date. What did you make of it, James? Did you like this one?
I really did, actually. It's not a bit awardsy. It is awardsy, totally.
I know, 100%. I was sort of playing that down. And it totally
no,
is, isn't it?
Fair enough. Whether it's his best performance, I don't know, but it's one of his most surprising performances. We've seen him play this sort of brainiac perhaps far too many times, and this sort of very physical, very aggressive role in ways was really surprising to see him do this and go there. The horrifying kind of relationship he has with his brother, who's more of the businessman of the ranch that they work on. It's less in the film, but in the book by Thomas Savage, they've come from the East Coast. Their family are very wealthy and they've sort of bought this ranch. And yet the Cumberbatch character, it's really his life, basically. This this cowpoke stuff is exactly what he lives for. He's not really, he doesn't really fit into this sort of moneyed existence that they came from. There's so many layers to this film as well. Again, without going into spoilers, sort of a film that deals with sexuality a lot, which was really interesting. It looks absolutely staggering. It was shot in New Zealand, but it's meant to be sort of 1920s Montana. It looks incredible. The cinematography on it is absolutely beautiful. There's so much to like about it. I mean, it's Jane Campion, of course. It's her first movie in 12 years.
Yeah.
She obviously did Top of the Lake, two seasons of that in between. But, I mean, this is what I think it's up there with one of her best. I mean, right up there with The Piano, which obviously garnered her a lot of awards. So I don't really know yet what this is going to be up against in the award season, but it's surely got to be a very strong contender.
I would think so, yes. I liked it more than The Piano, I have to say, and I didn't think that that was possible because I did love The Piano at the time. But I think this has just got even more going on. And it is, as you say, about sexuality. It also deals with alcoholism, toxic masculinity again. It's also just, without, again, giving away any spoilers, you think it's one type of film, and then you begin to suspect it's something else, and it has a killer blow at the end that is just fantastic, that makes you want to watch the film from the beginning again. So it's almost, it's a thriller, a sort of detective type of film, as well as being this experience as well. It's very sort of immersive. You feel like you're there. You feel like you can smell Phil when he starts shuffling around the house in his pongy cowboy gear. And I mean, I don't think I've seen a banjo playing scene as threatening as this since Deliverance. I mean, he manages to make everything just insulting, rude, aggressive, and dangerous, which I don't think I've seen Cumberbatch do before. Certainly not Doctor Strange.
No, it's about 1,000 million miles away from his character in Doctor Strange. Well, he normally plays the sort of the kind of heroic-ish lead on some level. So although I'd say Phil is probably co-lead in this, would you say? But
yeah.
He just hasn't had an opportunity or hasn't found the right role until now. And thank God it's kind of with someone as adept as Jane Campion sort of handling it, really. I mean, as you said earlier, you're just never quite sure the direction this is going in. You're never quite sure of the outcome. At a certain point, he befriends Rose's son, Peter, played by Cody Schmidt McPhee, who's a very sort of effeminate, delicate flower, really, completely the opposite to Phil. And then you're very worried as to what might happen between them. That's just one strand that this goes down where you think, well, what's going to happen next? I was constantly asking myself, well, what is going to happen next in this? I just don't know.
I've heard a lot about Benedict Cumberbatch in this film. I understand he's great. I haven't seen it yet myself. What I want to know is, how's my boy Jesse Plemons? I love a bit of Plemons.
Your boy Jesse? Oh.
A bit of Plemonade.
Yeah.
How's Plemons. The Plemonade in this one?
Yep. The Plemons is amazing. And I think it's lovely to see him and his real life partner, obviously Kirsten Dunst, playing husband and wife in this. And they do bring that real, there's a real connection between the two that you can't manufacture, that really, really works for this. He plays this role very, very well, doesn't he? The sort of chunky, nice guy who's sort of a bit pushed around by somebody, but with great empathy and with great sort of soul. And yeah, if you love Jesse Plemons in Fargo, or you love him in the recent Antlers, or any of those sort of things, he's doing that thing again and doing it brilliantly. And also, I loved seeing Kirsten Dunst play something completely different. She's playing a mother here, a woman who's sort of trying her best and not really succeeding in holding on to her life. And just everybody is excellent in this.
Yeah, we've also got Thomasin McKenzie turns up briefly, who was obviously recently in the lead in Last Night in Soho, Edgar Wright's film. And she has a small but sort of potent role as a kind of maid figure that works in Rose's. I never quite figured out what that was in the film. If it's a sort of, I think Kirsten Dunst described it as like a mill, but I think it's also sort of, it's almost like a restaurant for cowboys, basically.
It is. It's basically, if you're driving your cattle across Montana, this is where you go for your chicken dinner and a bed and a bit of whoring down the road. I say this like I know, like I regularly
drive. It sounded like you had personal experience, but I'm sure you haven't.
When I'm driving my cattle across Hackney, I like to find myself a whoring pub. But no, I think that's what it is. But yeah, no, it's really, really beautiful. Do you want to see it, Jordan, and find out what the power of the dog is? Because it is something.
Yeah, I'm desperate to see it. I haven't had the chance yet because I had horrible food poisoning last week and managed to miss all the screenings of the films, which is very sad. but I will be seeing it as soon as possible.
Well, you can see it in cinemas on Friday and on Netflix from the 1st of December. So don't worry, food poisoning is not going to slow you down. You'll be able to get your lemonade. Okay, shall we move on then? Let's talk plain talking, which is demystifying on-set jargon. This week, it's Last Looks. What's Last Looks? Anyone know?
Well, I cheated and had to look this up. Oh, I didn't know before. I know. You're not going to rely on my actual knowledge. It's hair and makeup related, basically. So it's the sort of last chance to be tarted up before you go on set and have your take, basically, or, you know, perform for a take.
It's also a checks thing. It's like, is everything in place? Is all the hair fine? Do we have lipstick on our teeth? Is the bruise that you've painted on correct? Last looks, please, because we're about to roll. So there we go. All right, shall we move on to our next film? Get your balls ready, boys.
You want to check on the kids? Let's check on the kids.
We got future doctors and lawyers, plus a couple tennis stars in this house.
The chances of achieving the kind of success that you're talking about is just very, very unlikely.
Okay, you're making a mistake, but I'm going to let you make it.
Watch him hit a few balls.
All right.
So tell me your names again.
I'm Venus.
I'm Serena.
So what'd you think?
So this is King Richard. James, another awards contender.
It really is. This is Will Smith playing Richard Williams, who is the father of Venus and Serena Williams, the incredible sisterly tennis players. And this is really their early life when they're both quite young, Venus and Serena. And Richard's got a plan, basically. He has a plan to turn these promising tennis players into stars. And well, obviously, that plan worked. And this is really about the journey they take in their youth before they played a professional match. He takes them through a couple of different coaches, played by Tony Goldwyn and then John Bernthal, both of whom are excellent. Yeah, it's really, as I say, it's their journey before they really become the stars that we know. The girls are played, Serena's played by Demise Singleton and Venus played by Sanaya Sidney, both sort of newcomers, both incredible in the film as well. But really, this is Will Smith's movie all the way. He's just remarkable in this. I'd seen people saying it's the best thing he's done since Six Degrees of Separation, which is a very long time ago in his career. But I think you could really have to say it's the best thing he's done since Ali, which obviously was pretty incredible. It's just an amazing performance.
I found it really annoying. I mean,
15 love.
Yeah, it's just so showboaty, isn't it? It's like, look at me, I've pulled my socks right up. I'm wearing tiny shorts and I'm talking in this very specific accent with a, what are we doing, Venus? What are we doing? I felt like I could always see Will Smith acting in this. I didn't feel at all immersed in it whatsoever. So it just did not work for me. I also found it a bit weird to tell the story of two absolute trailblazing women through the eyes and the lens of their father. Like, why can't we just tell the story of Venus and Serena and, you know, chart their amazing, you know, success and have the father in that? Because he's obviously hugely instrumental into that. He had a plan and nothing was going to stop him. I find the lens of this a bit curious. I know that both those sisters are exec producers on this film. They have their blessing of the Williams family. It's taken from the book that was written of the same name. So it's all very much authentic. But to me, it didn't feel authentic.
Ronaldo Marcus Green, who directed Monsters and Men, I think he really steps up here as the director. The tennis stuff also, I've got to say, I thought the tennis stuff was really well done because often sports movies are very difficult to get right. I thought they did that really brilliantly. And I saw this film at the London Film Festival in a public screening. It was like a Friday night, 6 o'clock screening. There was no one from the movie there. They did a sort of filmed intro beforehand. And the public just went completely crazy for it. It just seemed like a really good, crowd-pleasing Friday night movie. And that's where I'd sort of position it if I was in a sort of marketing meeting as to how to sell this movie. That's how I feel it plays really well as a real crowd-pleaser with Big Willie Starr right at the top.
It's the sort of film that if it had gone to TIFF this year, that it would be the audience award and then it would be, you know, the go straight to the Oscars front bench. So, yeah. I totally see that, but I'm not a massive fan. But let's see. People may love it. It is out in cinemas this Friday. Go and see King Richard. Tell us whether you are on James's side or mine with it. Jordan, do you fancy it?
Again, I've heard good things from everyone except you, Jane. But what I'm most interested in is seeing if this might be the film that finally wins Big Willie's Best Actor Oscar. Feels like he's really pushing for it with this one. He's on the awards trail already, isn't he?
It feels like he's come to play, doesn't it? I mean, he's got his book out. He's, you know, really going to, you know, work the carpets, work the circuit. He equally is incredibly sort of focused. And if he wants something, you know, he generally gets it. So is this the one where, you know, Benedict Cumberbatch better get out of his way because he's coming for you?
I have to say, I do have a reasonable sense sometimes when I see a performance and you just go, Oscar, I saw that performance and just thought, he's going to get it. Or if he doesn't, he'll be extremely close to getting it, put it that way. Obviously, it really depends on what else we haven't yet seen that will be in the awards race. But so far, that's the one to beat for me.
So who else would Will Smith be going up against? Who does he have to beat, Jordan?
Well, I mean, the sort of front runners at the moment, I guess you would say, are Andrew Garfield for Tick, Tick, Boom, which we spoke about last week, of course. Again, you weren't the biggest fan, Jane, but a lot of people admired his performance in that film. Cumberbatch, obviously, we've just spoken about in The Power of the Dog. Denzel Washington, who's going to appear in The Tragedy of Macbeth later this year from Joel Coen. Been getting a lot of good notices for that. Maybe Leo as another shot with Adam McKay's Don't Look Up. That's coming out soon.
Yeah, that's the one we haven't seen yet. So that could be a big surprise.
Okay. It's time for alternative line reading. I'm going to do this one. It's a theme of the film we talked about first. So that's the theme of it. See if you know what this film is. I'm Henry VIII, I'm Henry VIII, I am.
I don't know, but I'd love to. I just want to hear you sing that again.
Wow, that was quite something.
Yeah, I have zero. I know that phrase, but I have zero idea where that's from.
It's a song in a ghostly movie.
Yeah, I'm struggling to place it.
Hang on, let me think. Is it, that sounds a bit ghost-like. As
carry
in Patrick Swayze keeping up Whoopi Goldberg at night with his rendition of I'm Henry the Eighth, I am.
Correct, James. Gold star for you. It's this.
Second verse, same as the first. I am Henry the Eighth, I am. Henry VIII, I am. I got married to the widow next door. She's been married 7 times before, and everyone was Henry, and that Willie Arthur. No, sir, him an eighth old man of Henry. Henry VIII, I am. Henry VIII, I am.
After my delightful singing, it's time to move on. Let's finish with this, s'il vous plaît.
Je t'avais jamais vu avant. Tu m'as pas dit comment tu t'appelais, Lily. Je suis chez ma grand-mère. Elle est morte la semaine dernière. J'aime bien faire des petites tiges de chocolat et les manger.
So this is Petit Maman. James, who is the little mother?
We have Nellie, played by Joséphine Sans. She's with her family at her grandmother's house. Her grandmother's passed away, and they're clearing out her possessions. And she skips off to play in the woods. And she meets another young girl who's sort of exactly her own age. And this young girl is played by Gabrielle Sans, who is Joséphine's sister. And they have a very sweet time between each other. And really, I don't feel like I should say too much more. It might just give away a rather huge spoiler in the film. But it's an incredibly gentle piece of work. It's only 70 minutes long as well.
Very short,
which, let's face it, we all love short films now and again. It's by Celine Sciamma, who last did Portrait of a Lady on Fire. That was such a huge film for her. This almost feels like a kind of little miniature piece by comparison, but certainly not something she just dashed off in 5 minutes. There's a hell of a lot of thought to this film. It's a very pure experience to watch as well. Very gentle, as I said, just really beautiful.
Yeah, it's very much about grief and childhood, and there is a sort of magical aspect to it that happens that we won't say what. Presented in a very straightforward way, isn't it? It's not fancy at all, as you say. It's extremely sort of a plain film, but that actually packs an emotional wallop. this again has been talked about in terms of awardsy things. It will probably do well on sort of the critics awards bodies throughout the year, I imagine. But is it something you actually want to go to the cinema for? Because it is quite slight.
I don't know. I saw it at home because it was as part of the Berlin Film Festival back in February, when, of course, Berlin was a virtual festival, effectively. So we had all these films piped into our, you know, our house, as it were. And it was quite a strange experience to watch a Berlin competition movie at home. And it fitted well on my television screen, if you know what I mean.
It's very domestic, isn't it? It is very much about the domestic.
Yeah. I'm not sure if it's one you desperately need to see on the big screen, as beautiful as it is to look at. But then I guess if you're completely immersed in that world, as you would be when you're in a cinema, there's something to be said for that. I think just to sort of be sucked into her world, you know, in the dark, which is always a bit more difficult when you're watching from something at home.
Too true. Yes. There's a lovely scene in there as well. I love the fact that they cast these two real life sisters. There is a particularly delightful scene where they try to make pancakes and just make an absolute mess, and they're laughing and throwing sort of batter around and making an absolute mess. And it's so lovely. And if I was the parents of that child, I would love that that had been captured on film, that moment between those two sisters. It is delightful. Jordan, something you fancy?
Oh, yeah, 100%. Portrait of a Lady on Fire is one of my favourite films of the last few years, just a total masterpiece. Desperate to see this one. I was very sad to see that a certain cinema chain's surprise screening on Monday was this film, and there were widespread reports of people walking out when they realised it was a French language film, which I find very disappointing.
I read about that too, and I was equally shocked. But how long did these people stay before they left?
I mean, I imagine minutes if you're getting put off by French subtitles. Yeah. This might be a case where it's been blown all out of proportion. It was like two people in Stevenage who walked out, and now
they suddenly realised they'd left the oven on and they left, and it was nothing to do with the film.
So it might be much ado about nothing. But yeah, if that is the case, that's very sad, because Celine Sciamma is one of the great filmmakers we have at the moment, and I will watch anything that she makes.
I don't think this is up there with Portrait of a Woman on Fire. I don't think it's the same as that at all. So I think if you are going in with those expectations, you could be disappointed. But it is the level of skill and the control of subject is as excellent as that film. And she, as you say, she is a wonderful filmmaker. Okay, so that is Petit Maman, which is in cinemas on Friday. Don't leave your oven on if you're going and then walk out when it's just started and give everyone the impression that you don't like foreign films. Go and see it and be intentional. Okay, so before we go, we do have time for a reader's question. And this is quite an interesting one. When you interview people, do you ever do it over dinner like you're on a weird date? Jordan, have you ever interviewed anyone over dinner like you're on a weird date?
Definitely not like I've been on a weird date. And, you know, if there's ever an option to do it over food, I would turn that down in a heartbeat, because that would just be far too awkward. But I have done occasional interviews. You tend to do this on set a lot, where you interview filmmakers or actors over lunch.
Yeah.
So you'll be speaking to them while they're on their downtime, and they have to eat because they've got no other downtime. I interviewed Brian Cox in his trailer on the set of The Autopsy of Jane Doe while he was eating his lunch. He was very polite and
good table manners.
Yeah, excellent table manners, as you'd expect from Mr. Cox. I interviewed Zack Snyder on the set of Army of the Dead while he was eating his lunch. He's picking at a salad. I think it was a chicken salad. Maybe there's a bit of Parmesan on there as well. Looked delicious. The surreal thing about that was, though, the fact that, you know, a few seats down, there were just people caked in necrotic zombie makeup, which was just very odd. Like, it was kind of off-putting to be eating your food while, you know, someone's flesh was peeling away. So, yeah, not by choice, just because I'm always worried that I'll, you know, spit some food out and just totally embarrass myself in front of, you know, a filmmaker I admire. But occasionally it does happen.
James, have you been on a weird dinner date with someone you're interviewing?
Well, the only one I could remember, I've done very few of those kind of things. And the only one I can remember is I had lunch with Elliot Gould at the Edinburgh Film Festival once. And that was fantastic because we had a proper, you know, hour and a half. It was like a Sunday. It was a Sunday roast kind of situation as well in this restaurant. So we had a proper amount of time to talk and eat. And it felt incredibly civilized, I have to say. I would like more lunch dates if they turn out to be like that. But yeah, most of the time we're more, you know, hotel bound, or as Jordan said, kind of set bound, where you're doing these kind of things.
I have done the on-set eating Stanley Tucci with a bowl of spaghetti, which, as you might expect, he twirled up and ate with absolute precision. And probably, I would imagine, was thinking, I could make this better, knowing Stanley. But I have had those weird, awkward dates. I went to a restaurant with Jessica Alba. We ordered a sharing plate, which was just a disaster, because I don't know about you, with sharing plates, you want to know the person you're sharing a plate with, because you're like, I'm going to like stuff this cheese in my mouth and like it's many. And you're like, no, don't eat that, because I've already had like one of those and you haven't had one of those. And I'm eating that thing, and don't eat two of them because there's only three. But if you're with somebody that you're trying to interview, it's incredibly awkward because you don't know them. And so you're just sort of picking at them and like going, oh God, if I eat the Parma ham, will they be annoyed because they fancied it? So there was that aspect. And the other thing is as well, just like trying to eat and chat and listen to somebody and put your questions across to them. Nobody has a conversation when they have dinner, do they? Whilst they're sort of properly chatting and trying to have a proper conversation. That's quite tricky. And I also once had a lunch with Tom Hiddleston that I thought I was going to like a 20-minute interview, and I ended up having a two-hour lunch with him and talked about skiing and shared sushi with him, which was very nice. I enjoyed that one. That was fine. But yeah, as a rule, I think it's quite a tricky thing to master. And I always remember Jamie went for sushi with a famous director, and the director put down his chopsticks and Jamie picked them up by accident and then was absolutely panicking all the way through the meal that he was eating with the wrong chopsticks. Total Jamie, of course. But yeah.
Classic Jamie.
It is classic Jamie. But yes, the weird dates are not things I would choose if they said, would you like to go for dinner with X, Y, or Z?
And then who pays at the end as well?
Always awkward as well. To be fair, I like that as well, because with Hiddleston, he got his card out and was like going to pay for it. And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, I'm doing the interview, I'll pay for it. And we had like one of those awkward British tussles over a credit card, which was very nice and very typically Tom Hiddleston, the politest, loveliest man in show business. Okay, so that is our dinner dates. We'll try it. We should get Jamie to think of weird ones he's been on, because I'm sure he's had terrible eating incidents with famous people. We just don't do them. Okay, so that's it for this week. What's your film of the week, James?
Power of the Dog by Mile.
I would ask Layla, but she's been spirited away. But I think I'm going to speak for her a little bit, and I think she'd probably say the same, because I know she was very excited to talk about that one. Jordan, you've only seen Ghostbusters, so I guess it's your film of the week.
Yeah. I'm going to say my film of the week, definitely Ghostbusters. No other film I saw this week came close.
Yeah, cool. And thank you for stepping up. And he's now sitting in the dark, listeners, fading away like the ghostly sort of creature that he is. So thank you for coming out of the gloaming and helping us out on this. And we hope that Layla is okay wherever she is in her parallel universe. But for now, let's say goodbye. So say goodbye, James.
Bye.
Say goodbye, Jordan.
Goodbye.
Very spooky. Goodbye.
Eggman! Batman, what happened? Are you okay?
He slimed me.
Afraid of no ghosts.